Dave.
Hey, Richard.
Would you like to do our introduction?
I would. So welcome to episode 5 of Brickyard Composition Podcast. Today we have something a little special to introduce. It's David. So I'm Dave, and may I introduce David?
Yes, this is David.
David Griffin.
So welcome to Brickyard Composition. David Griffin and Dave Allen. And yeah, Richard Gabriel
David Griffin
with Brickyard
is our
Composition.
Guest today. As you know, Dave Allen from our previous 4 episodes, the co-founder of Brickyard. Wait, you're actually the founder because you came up with the name Brickyard.
That's true. I did come up with the name. And, yeah.
I don't think David has heard that story yet. So should we fill him in on what Brickyard Composition is, or is that part of the lost material?
No, it's a mystery. It's just part of the mystery.
Oh, that's true.
No.
That's true. It's part of the lost material. So
yeah, that's the lost material. Yeah, we'll just like the story about how we went to a bar, I let you get drunk, and then I would like try to convince you drunkenly to start an art podcast with me. So like, no, this is a great idea, Richard.
And here we are. It's the 5th episode, and we're all quarantined thanks to the coronavirus. Uh-huh. And that's our topic for today. We're going to discuss how the coronavirus is impacting the art world, primarily with like some of the big art fairs that have been scheduled. I know Art Dubai is doing an online catalog. I just saw something for, I think it was Basel in Hong Kong. On Instagram.
Yeah.
So a lot of international art fairs are being impacted by this. People can't go to the venues and see the work in person. And, you know, it creates a lot of challenges and it creates other kinds of opportunities. So we're going to explore those today in our podcast. Any immediate thoughts? Like, what do you guys think about virtual exhibits?
Well, I think that they've always been an important part of any, you know, sort of gallery website, you know, putting up the artwork so that people can see it, learn information about it, et cetera, and so forth. Obviously, for art that's very textural or that has some kind of component to it where sort of engaging with it in a personal way loses something in the translation. But, you know, that there are ways to kind of address that within the written materials, support materials, that can kind of explain that there might be an effect visible when one is actually viewing the work that is not translated into the methods that, you know, the images that you're seeing on a screen. I mean, I think that in as much as art fairs can follow the gallery exhibition model and sort of share the images that way, it's, you know, definitely a, sort of a step, I guess, in the right direction in terms of representing the artists and making sure that the work is available for public viewing. Obviously, a lot of the kind of mechanics, if you will, of an art fair in terms of how gallerists or how artists cultivate patrons, how they address collectors, how they address the public on a, you know, sort of a general sense, all of that is missing. But, you know, there might be ways to liven that up that, you know, tap a little bit more into social media. So I think that's my general sort of take on it.
Yeah, like everybody makes a cocktail at home and like live takes the virtual tour together at the same time. That could be fun, actually. You know,
there's a joke in there maybe about how everyone
maybe we should host something like that.
Exactly. Like everyone goes to Art Basel just to get drunk in person and pretend they're looking at art, right? So everyone can just pretend they're looking at art and get drunk from the comfort of their own home while streaming Art Basel Hong Kong.
Right, exactly.
Right? No, so I mean, this is the problem. Like, I think, like what you said, David, my initial instinct is, okay, this is great that we are finding ways around this sort of quarantine and isolation and social distancing to still represent artists and get their artwork out there, which is great. The problem is I feel like we already have this issue. There's this been the sea change that people think superficial scrolling is already a valid replacement for deep viewing of art.
Right.
And so long term, my fear is this is going to solidify that, right? That now, mm-hmm. now we have a time where everything is by screen. And people are going to go, oh, this is okay. And then we're going to come out of this, you know, with even more that notion that that superficial scrolling is good enough. Right. And that makes me nervous because I don't think it is. And it's not just texture, because I think you could have really good images that actually capture texture that are shot really well, even that. But, you know, scale and size, and people aren't looking from good screens. You know, most people's computer screens aren't calibrated, you know, sRGB, and they're probably actually viewing from a phone, right? And they probably have their blue filter on and don't even realize it. You know what I mean? So I'm sort of afraid that it might, in the end, solidify superficial viewing as the norm. I don't know. Yeah.
I think we've been on this path for a while now, and I remember hearing a really great interview with Jack White from the White Stripes, and he said exactly, you know, what you're saying, where they were actually asking him in the interview about how new technologies have impacted the music industry, and he was speaking to that, but then he said, well, you know who I really feel sorry for? Are the painters and the sculptors who put countless hours into their work, and now people are just scrolling through Instagram thinking, oh, that's cool, neat, next one, awesome, interesting, and no one really takes more than a couple of seconds to view the work. So that creates a pretty serious issue in people, you know, forming a deep connection with an artwork. But I'm just thinking now, even with displays in physical spaces, like, you know, I recently got to go to the Louvre for the first time. I went to Paris, and I was shocked. And you don't have to go to Paris to see this. You could see it anywhere, but it was especially obvious with the Mona Lisa. There were hordes of people, and there's only one painting in the room, so you could tell which room the Mona Lisa was in because it was overflowing. You knew that had to be where Leonardo's painting was. And I went in because, you know, this is my chance. I've got to go see it. And one, I couldn't get anywhere near it, but two, a large majority of the people were not looking at the artwork. They were looking at their phone while taking a picture of the artwork. And it was the same at the Musée d'Orsay with the Van Goghs. It actually drove me crazy. So I think, Dave, you're right. This kind of is going to solidify that. But I wonder if we're already – I mean, I guess – we're already in the position where this might just seal the deal, and people, you know, they're going to just be perfectly comfortable with a reproduction of the work. David. Well,
Hello?
Yeah. What is your response?
I think that, this is a trend that's been developing. And, you know, I think that particularly younger people are just more and more comfortable with the idea that your life is contained in your phone, and it's both with you everywhere you go, but it's also at arm's length in a sense. And Instagram is definitely feeding this as well. I have an Instagram account. I do post basically architectural photos to it. And I consider it part of the business that I do because I work in real estate. And I'm fascinated by architecture. But at the same time, I know full well that nothing beats the experience of meeting the building on the street, as it were.
Sure.
I mean, that's the kind of the way that the building actually interacts with its surroundings is that's 9/10 of architecture right there. How does it address the street? How does it address the neighboring buildings? How does it fulfill a function? And you just can't get that on Instagram. I think art has a lot of depth. It has a lot of mutability. art is something that changes with light, it changes with distance, it changes with the angle, and you cannot replicate that on Instagram. But we are, basically, we do have, I think a culture that is inclined to accept the facsimile on its own basis. And it wouldn't surprise me if there are younger artists out there who are making work always with the thought at the back of their mind, how will this photograph?
Oh, of course. That's a great point.
I mean, that's sort of the scary thing, is that I think art, the media, they're all going to sort of follow this small two-dimensionality. And you said, when you talked about distance, like, that's a big thing for me too, right? Because even if it, let's say it's even artwork that was created digitally, I don't think you can justify saying it will represent just as well on a screen, because the fact is there's scale and there's distance and there's interaction. I think of Richard, like, I have a painting of yours hanging up in my living room, one of Richard's magic carpets. Mm-hmm. And it sort of reminds me of Chuck Close. So you look at the later Chuck Close stuff and you get sort of three paintings to the price of one, right? You walk down the hallway in the museum and you sort of glance a Chuck Close painting in a room and it almost looks hyper-realistic, one of his later paintings, right? And you go, oh, okay, this is like a very realistic portrait. So you enter the room and suddenly you have something that's just an abstract portrait, right? And you go, oh, this is abstract. But because of the scale of it, very quickly as you approach it, it becomes complete, like, abex. Well, not abex, but, you know, complete just abstract, non-objectional, like, painting, right, as you get close enough. And there's actually a change of how his paintings are viewed with the proximity. And I think of your carpets, Richard, where from far away it actually looks like textile. Right. It looks like perfect symmetry and all this. Right. You can't tell it's a painting on Japanese paper. And as you get closer, you start to notice that there's not actually perfect symmetry, that these brushstrokes are uneven and imperfect in sort of a micro sense. But on a macro sense, they all form this very symmetric image. And as you get closer, you go,
it's a good point. It's a good point. That work definitely benefits from being viewed both at a distance and up close, and it has a lot to do with the transition, and David spoke to that, and seeing it in different light and from different angles. I mean, the gold, for example, it changes its luminosity based on what angle the light is set and what angle you are from the picture and the relationship between those three points in space. And the opposite is true too. Like, I have other works that you remind me of, which are the opposite of that. The bird paintings, you may be familiar with those. I think David, yes. you have one of those bird paintings.
I have one of them. Yep. I'm looking at it right now.
When I was working with those, I came up with the term reversed impressionism because It was the reversed experience. Like, with impressionism, it's sort of like the Chuck Close, like you're saying, Dave. From a distance, you see the subject. Everything comes into focus, and it's only upon closer inspection, as you get closer and closer to the surface, that it breaks down into complete abstraction, just dabs of color side by side. But with the bird paintings that I was making, from a distance, you really don't see anything other than a luminous haze. It might just appear to be a color field painting like a Mark Rothko. But as you get closer, you see the subtle nuances and that there are forms within that sort of ethereal background that crystallize as you get face to face with the work and trying to photograph that. Now, I'm not a professional photographer, so I've always struggled. You, Dave, would probably take a much better picture of the painting. However, I don't know that any photograph could really do it justice, especially if it were reduced to the size of a phone. I've battled those issues a lot. And I know you make some miniatures. You make some miniature scaled photos that likewise, I mean, people can't experience them in the same way because they can't get close enough to them, I don't think. Or have you found that it doesn't get in between the viewer and the photo?
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the thing, is these miniatures sort of beckon you to come closer, and you get close and you see details that, like, it's just not the same as pinch zooming, even for these miniatures, right? There is definitely a proximity thing. It's like what David was saying, even about buildings, especially buildings, right? You have perspective issues. Like, you look at architecture, the lines, you know, converge, you know, your point at infinity changes with your physical presence. Right. And architecture plays with that a lot. So I don't know. So I'm interested, David, because you're pointing out, though, that there is a good component to this, that more we need to be better about also presenting these things online. Right. So, you know, this might be a good thing. So I guess my question is, how do you think there's a good way that we could do that, and also through that encourage people to view in person? Is there a good way to accomplish both?
I mean, I think almost every anything where you're presenting material that is online. This used to be said, I remember taking a class at college in art once, and we went through whatever the paintings were, and, you know, studied them all, and the paintings, of course, were reproduced as slides and projected on the screen. This was a while ago. People still had slides that they were using. And at the end of each class, the professor was very careful to say, please realize that although these are very, very high quality images of the paintings, they're not going to capture the specific experience of standing in front of the painting. And I believe that in one case, he made the point of Renoir's Boating Party, which is, I believe, in the National Gallery, Washington, D.C. And he said, you know, there is a quality of light in this painting which cannot be photographed. And a lot of people look at the reproductions and they think, oh, it's a sort of sentimental, you know, gathering of, you know, cute young people having lunch or something. And he says the way the light falls in the painting itself is not, we can't replicate it as an image. So I think that if you build that into whatever the presentation is and say, you know, please be aware of the scale of the work or something to do with the color, simply can't be communicated through what you're looking at. This gives you a good idea of it, but, you know, please do stop by and see it, or be sure to check it out if you can. I think that that should just be part of the boilerplate. I think that galleries, when they're putting up their exhibitions, they go on and on and on about how it's the, you know, the kind of gobbledygook that people seem to churn out these days, but they don't really do a very good job of addressing the work as work and saying, this is what the work actually looks like. You know, because the image itself is just, as a online, it's just not going to do it 100%.
Yeah.
It's more kind of like, it's an approximation of what it would be like to see the actual.
Yeah. I think that the virtual exhibits, they obviously increase the accessibility. So I don't have to buy a ticket and fly to Hong Kong. I can take the virtual tour, which is very cool. I mean, a lot of people can see the artwork now, you know, far more than ever before. So I think it's a great opportunity to discover new artists and search and explore. And then, you know, you can do some research and read about them and get your curiosity and excitement piqued to eventually see them in person someday. I mean, I would never want to say that the facsimile replaces the original, but it can serve the original in some ways, just in increasing the accessibility and the discoverability of artists and, you know, hopefully getting people out to more galleries once all of this clears up. That's my hope, but we'll see. We'll see how it turns out if we ever get out of this damn quarantine.
Well, I think that that could be incorporated into this, and I don't know whether they're doing it with the Hong Kong Art Fair, and I very, very, very have seldom seen it in the gallery web pages, but include a photo or a short film of the installation as an installation. You know, walk around the gallery, let's see the paintings hanging on the walls. In other words, just don't give us the image of the artwork. Give us an image of the artwork hanging. Give us an image of the
environment.
Put one of the people who works at the gallery in front of it so we have a sense of relative scale.
Yeah.
So
the realism of a back of a head obfuscating the view. Yeah.
Exactly. Hey, I love
wonder
it.
Wonder if it's a Magritte.
Yeah, no, I mean, do a virtual tour that includes all the empty, you know, little plastic wine cups. Taking photographs of installations and, like, for example, filming the art fair, maybe going through it with a camera, a la Stanley Kubrick, and kind of like seeing how the booths look, what the art. And there's another thing about the art fair that is very, I think it's very important, is the idea of contrast. And that's something that, you know, actually galleries don't have a lot of, that's not something people are going out of their way to create, but it is there. In other words, one booth can have art that's very different from the booth across the hall. If you saw either one of those in just by themselves, you might think different thoughts than when they were put together.
Well, yeah, no, that's it's a like great point, the sequence.
Yeah,
it's like anti-curation, right? Like,
right.
Because booths don't communicate. So a curator's whole job is to like give a flow and sort of meaning to what's in proximity to what. And yeah, the art fair almost is the anti-curation can almost.
I went to the Winter Antique Show, and it was fascinating to have a gallery there that sold globes and maps across from one that sold, you know, African masks and totemic objects. And, you know, right down the, you know, all visible within one's field of view, there was, you know, 18th century German and Baroque Russian furniture. And that kind of idea of contrast, I think, makes those pieces come alive. And sometimes it can make something really stand out and be like, you know, in the midst of all of this, this is really unique and amazing. And sometimes it goes the other way and you're like, well, I'm looking at, you know, one, two, three different types of art, and this really is jarring to me. I don't know that I like it as much. So it's a double-edged sword, but it's part of the experience of going to a major museum or going to a major art fair where you're seeing all of these things kind of arranged in a way that they're addressing each other as well. That's part and parcel of what the experience is. And that's missing when you just do it as a series of images.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Like you need to really drive home the fact that you're not really viewing the artwork and having sort of environmental images of the works is really important. I still belabor the original point I made. I just have this fear that like, yeah, this is, you know, if people do it too well, it's going to sort of kill live viewing. And maybe, yeah, if we do a good job of driving home the fact that you're not really viewing it live, that's fine. I think of this, I was at a showing, an exhibition in Toulouse a few years back. And there was this piece that from across the room, I entered the room and it just looked like a glossy white circle, right? Like protruding from the wall. And you're like, okay, what is this? So you get closer and you realize it's sort of this white metal lacquer. So it's like painted metal. And there was a face beneath this sort of white paint, right? This glossy white paint.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of Richard of your bird paintings at the time. Oh. And I actually was like, I want to send this to Richard. Like, this reminds me of him because from far away, it just looks like nothing. And you have to get close and you actually see the face and the eyes and the mouth of this woman. It was really intriguing. It was just super powerful. I don't remember the name of who did it. It was a local artist, I believe, in Toulouse or anything. But it just, you know, sort of made an impression on me that you're like, oh, wow, you have to get right up on it. And I took out my phone to take a picture of it for Richard, and I realized there is no way to photograph it, right? Like, there's no way to photograph it where it doesn't just look like a white circle.
Wow.
And you're like, I'm nervous that this kind of thing is going to be dead because, like we were saying, like, it doesn't photograph well. Like, are we gonna lose that? Do you think we can, with enough like addendums, like, hey, this isn't real, this isn't real, this isn't the real thing, you can't see the texture, you can't see that, you know, like
the thing is this, I feel that this is something that has impacted social life at every level.
Yeah,
it's been really remarkable to me, because a lot of what I did as a professional in the art world was events management, and, you know, going out to gallery openings. I work with a nonprofit and, you know, trying to get people to come and see the work. I'll tell you, it's been 20 years of a curve of people just not engaging on the social level. It's like, oh, you know, the concert, yeah, I'm not going to go to that. You know, go to the film premiere, nah, I'm not going to go to that. Go to this, go to that. No, I'm not going to go to that. I'm going to stay home and play on my computer and watch new video games. You know, it's just, there's been this kind of sequestering and sort of lack of interest in that type of activity that's been growing. And I think to a certain extent, it's a generational thing. But it's always just sort of like, oh, it's so much easier to just, you know, get home from work and turn on the TV than it is to actually, what, go out to a cocktail party, go out to this, go out to that, all the rest of this. Ah, it feels like work. I have to put on makeup or this or a suit or whatever the heck. So I'd say that this is something that's been growing for the last 20 years. It's not just coming up. And I say it's everything. It's not just the arts. Anytime you try to get people out, I run a literary series. It was very, very interesting how you could have a really, you know, great author come, and we usually did get a good turnout. But I was thinking, gee, if I realized that this person was here, and of course I'm the one putting it together, I'd not expect to see, you know, 100 people at this reading. And, you know, we were happy if we got 30 or 40. That was a respectable crowd. And I think that that's just been a trend. Now, one thing that I will say is that with this coronavirus quarantine, and what's happening, and the fact that everything is now shut down, and no, you can't go to the museum, and you can't go to the concert, and you can't go to the cocktail party, people are going to kind of want those things back at the end.
Yeah,
this isn't just everybody sitting around, oh, I'm just cocooning, I'm just going to Netflix and chill. No, this is this is, yeah, you stick your toe outside the door, and, you know, some idiot is going to shoot it off for all you know. So once that is no longer a situation, and I'm hoping that that's the case, people are going to be like, you know what? I want to go to an art gallery opening, goddammit. I want to see some actual art. I want to see people. I want to walk, you know, down the street. I want to put something fun on. I want to have a cocktail at a bar. I don't want to just sit at home. So there might be a kind of a backlash to what Dave's, you know, problem is, built into this scenario. I mean, I've been here, last time I was in New York City was 2 weeks ago. So I'm hopefully over the hump for, you know, having, you know, picked up this thing in terms of that one visit. But, you know, I miss going down there. I miss being able to just walk down the streets. I miss being able to have a, you know, face-to-face meeting with my colleagues and my friends. And I'm looking forward to doing that again. So For people who have kind of, oh, well, you know, the facsimile is good enough. Oh, I'm not going to go to the exhibition. I'll just look at it online. Something is, they're going to be aware that they are actually missing something. So it might be, there might be a move towards, you know, sort of reinvigorating that experience. People might be more curious about it. They might be more eager to go out and actually do things.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is they won't take it for granted. I feel like we kind of so easily dismiss things because we take them for granted. We just figure, we assume they're always going to be, there's going to be another opening. Oh, I get so many invites to openings. Oh, I get so many invites to parties. I get so many, you know, and so it's easy to just ignore them and, you know, see a reproduction. Or, you know, text your friend to see what they're up to, or, you know, but now that we don't have the option really to go out and enjoy all those things, yeah, you might be right. Maybe it'll swing in the opposite direction. People might actually really appreciate the opportunity to get out and see things live in person, interact with people. On the other hand, I wonder if the coronavirus and now social distancing and, you know, you're not allowed to shake hands. You have to bump elbows, or, I mean, I think we're at a point now where you can't even bump elbows. You have to stand 10 feet away from everybody. Will we ever recover from the germophobia of this?
Right.
I mean, how long will that last? Where, you know, you might really want to go now, you know, once coronavirus passes, right, you might really want to go to a gallery or a museum or a concert or a film or something. But in the back of your mind, are you worried about catching something because of, you know, the scare of this whole process?
I mean, I hope what David said comes true, that people sort of crave, you know, physical proximity to people after all this, that they, you know, that's the opposite reaction, that people crave, you know, being present in, for like art in person, you know. But yeah, because you're right, I think we do take a lot of this for granted. Sort of tangentially, it just reminded me my cousin John. He works for an organization in Philadelphia called ArtReach, and their whole goal, their whole thing is they remove barriers for the disability community and low income people to access the arts.
Wow,
which is really cool, right? Because he goes, there's entire communities of people who actually want to see art. So all of us, like, you know, we're a podcast, we're three white dudes on a podcast talking about stuff, you know, already. But I joke, but like, they're, you know, like, those of us in this privileged, who are privileged enough to turn down opportunities for exhibitions, right?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Which I have in Toulouse and stuff, like, oh, I don't feel like putting on pants, I'm going to decline. And then my cousin, I was talking to him in a family get together, you know, the last time I was in the US, and he was just saying, like, no, you don't think about, like, how many of these, like, disability community members and low income people would love to participate in this, want to see this stuff, and they just can't.
Yeah, right. No, like, it's so true. I was talking to a bus driver. We had reserved a coach bus. We're going to New York, a big group. You know, talk about privileged. And we were going to go see the MoMA, and our bus driver was curious. He was talking to me about the trip and where we were going, and, you know, the art museum, how he hadn't been there for some years. And he was talking about his family and how he'd love to take his family there, but he was asking what the ticket costs are now. And it's like 20 some dollars at least for most of these museums. And then depending on if it's a special exhibition, it could be more. It's insane. So yeah, you're right. There are a lot of people who can't get in to see them, but then that's where the accessibility of the virtual exhibit comes in, but it doesn't really solve the problem of what's lost in translation. Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned scale, and I know we spoke about that in a previous episode with Rothko, because when you look at a reproduction of a Rothko, you know, it's very easy to dismiss it because you don't get the sense of the subtlety and the nuance or the scale. I mean, when you match your body scale to the canvas, it really overwhelms you, and it seems so monumental when you stand in front of it. But even the smaller scale works. And I know you just mentioned that you can pinch zoom because you can do that on phones and tablets, and you can see detail. But Dave, because you work with miniatures, you know, what do you think is lost in the reproduction, even if you can pinch zoom?
I mean, so there's a couple things with the pinch zoom. There's assuming that the image is actually a high enough quality that when you zoom in, you actually see more quality, which with compression, a lot of times that's not the case, right? So the problem is when you pinch zoom or you zoom on a computer, right, we have the issue of, is the actual image on Instagram or the website, is it at a high enough resolution that when you zoom in, you actually see more detail? Because these days there's so much compression added and stuff that a lot of times you don't actually see any more detail. Right. It just crappy detail bigger. And so that it's not always a good way to see something closer, because there actually isn't more detail there digitally, right?
Right.
And we still have this thing that when we zoom, we look closer our screen, but our screens only have so many pixels in them, right? So as you get closer, that like the pixels per inch, you know, for our field of view actually goes down, right? There's not really, you don't get to see the nuance. So even with my miniatures, I have a series of miniatures that are actually on Fuji Instax film.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Actually, yeah, you have three of those.
Yeah, I have
Richard.
Three of those, and I love the scale of them. And it makes the work even more powerful for me when I'm thinking about, you know, not just how many exposures you must have used to take the image, but the intimacy, like holding it in my hand.
Yeah.
And uh-huh. looking at it from, like, you know, less than an arm's length. I don't know how you could reproduce that online. You know, like you said, if they have a high res image, you can pinch zoom. But unless, like David had mentioned, they have it also, you know, like an addendum with other images of pictures with people, or a picture of it in someone's hand, you don't necessarily appreciate how tiny a miniature would be.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the problem, yeah.
I mean, last year I took a trip to Chicago and I went to the Chicago Art Institute. And I don't know if either of you gentlemen are familiar with the Thorne collection at the Chicago Art Institute.
No, not me.
What it is it's a collection of miniature rooms.
Ah.
And they were devised by a woman who was an interior designer. And she created them for an exposition in Chicago, in which she was trying to illustrate different styles of architecture around the world, including the United States. And there are currently, I believe it's 100 rooms or so. These are very small. I think the first ones were made in the 1920s, early 1930s. They are absolutely extraordinary. Some of them are replicas of real rooms in castles, palaces, and large houses around the world. Others are sort of fictitious, but they're based on architectural types. I took several photographs of the collection while I was there, and I posted one to Instagram, and people looked at it and said, which house were you visiting when you took this picture? Because the level of detail of those miniatures is so extraordinary that my picture of it simply looked like an architectural digest photo of a life-size room in some sort of Gothic house somewhere.
Yeah.
And I said, well, no, this is a miniature room, and it's probably about 6x12, all told.
Inches.
Yeah. So,
yeah, so then you took a picture with a quarter next to it, and they were like, where did you find a giant novelty quarter?
Right, exactly. So I did take a couple pictures where there was one where there was a child kneeling. There's a rail, so you can kneel down and look into these rooms, which are set into the walls. Like they look like paintings until you get up to them, and then you realize they're set into the walls. They're fully three-dimensional. And so that helped fix the scale of what the other images were. But without that one shot, all of those rooms were so, and it was because they were so beautifully done, they simply looked like very ornate interiors. They did not look like miniatures. So yeah, I can see that as being a tremendous problem. And I think the shot of maybe the artist's hand showing something can really kind of drive the point home that we're looking at something that's, you know, not only very complex, but also very small.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's hard to do. It's like the scale, like you're saying, of color, certain color field paintings, or like I was talking about Chuck Close too. You have both ends of the spectrum, like not realizing how big, you know, something is, how small something is, and transmitting that like scale is just such a hard thing to portray in virtual exhibits. I think that.
Yeah, which kind of has a lot to do with the topic for our next episode, which is collecting art.
Oh, yeah.
I am always amazed at how many people are willing to pull the trigger based on a reproduction. I myself, I can't even buy a pair of jeans without trying them on. I can't imagine spending tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars on artwork without seeing it face to face. But maybe those collectors are already familiar with specific artists. They follow them, so they kind of know they've built a certain degree of trust with the artist's work, and they kind of know what they're going to get. But I don't know, David. I think you have a lot of experience with this. I mean, how are people so willing to spend money based on a reproduction?
I think it really depends at sort of what you're looking for and who the people are that you're talking about. If you're talking about, there's a certain class of buyer that's looking for an investment, and as long as people say, well, this is what you should invest in, he'll buy it. He's probably not putting it on any wall where he's going to look at it. He's probably owns it with eight other people, and he's putting it in storage somewhere, uses collateral, you know. So, yes, there's always buyers for whom the actual appearance of the thing is not as important. There are people who buy because it's fashionable. Someone says, oh, you simply must have a Jeff Koons rabbit made out of, stainless steel that's five floors high. And so they say, well, I'll get one, and then they put it somewhere, and then they don't think about it again. Not every art purchase is made because the person knows or cares anything about art.
Right.
To be perfectly frank, a lot of art purchasing is made on a whim, or because it seems cool, or, well, I need something over the sofa. So those buyers are probably much, much more comfortable with the idea of buying it the way you would buy anything out of a catalog. People who really know about art or collect it seriously or are buying the big paintings for the big reasons, they absolutely must see it in person. That hasn't changed at all.
Okay, that's good. That's good to hear.
I don't think anybody who is really interested in art would ever make a purchase without seeing the work in person, because there's just too much. There's too much there that you're going to know. There was one case, I believe, I don't want to misspeak. I'm not going to name the names because I'm not entirely sure of the details, but there was a person who was an art collector. He was, he was kind of starting out, and there was a work that came up that was interesting to him. It was a very well-known artist. He saw it online and he bought the painting. But because he got the catalog number wrong, he actually bought the next painting.
Oh man.
Now, and then it came to his house and, they installed it or whatever. And he's someone who has several homes. And so he had it for a couple of months before he even took a look at it. When he looked at it, he's like, I don't think this is the right painting. It was by the same artist. It was.
I thought you were going to say he didn't even notice.
No, he did notice. And then he and the gallery got into this big lawsuit about, who owned what, because at that point they had already sold the other painting. The one that he wanted had gone to someone else.
Wow.
And they said, well, you bought this and this was the catalog number you wanted, and it's the same artist and the same, the same series and everything. So I forget how that turned out, but I mean, that would be one way that, I would say to people, don't buy things like this online. You have to go in there. You have to actually see the work and know what you're getting yourself into.
This gets to, so one of the emails I got from the art world about coronavirus and responses from Artsy, right? And Artsy is just sort of blown up as like this sort of tour de force in selling artworks online. Their whole sort of thing is predicated on, I get emails from them. Oh, hey, look, there's a new work by Kandinsky, one of his sketches for sale. Like, do you want to buy it? And that's their whole shtick. And so, of course, they're supporting virtual exhibitions during this time. Mm-hmm. And you wonder if for them it's good, because they're sort of, I think they do a lot of business for people buying artworks based on facsimiles, based on, just photos and images. So, I mean, there's clearly a whole marketplace for people who just buy expensive art, not having ever seen it in person, which to me feels a little crazy, but it exists.
Yeah. I mean, it's there. It will probably get to be a bigger segment of the art buying public. But, you know, we have to remember that that type of thing might not be as new as we think it is.
Yeah.
If you go back to the turn of the last century when collectors were amassing collections like the ones that we see at the Frick, for example. You know, Henry Clay Frick was a very intelligent person. In many ways, he was not very pleasant to deal with. He had a magnificent art collection. Was he an art expert himself? No. He hired an art expert, said, this is basically what I want. Here's the checkbook. Go out and get it. And I don't think that he involved himself in every purchase. I don't know that he really, you know, cared for art the way that some other people do. I think that he thought it was important. I think he thought it carried a lot of social capital. I'm very glad of the fact that, you know, he turned over the collection and the house to become a museum. I think it's one of the greatest museums in the world. But, you know, people like that, they had buyers for them. You know, Mrs. Isabella Stewart Gardner, for example, with her beautiful palace in Boston, going out buying up all these masterworks by, you know, Titian. Did she see the Titian when she bought it? She did not. She had an advisor over in Paris who said, this is available. This is what it depicts. This is why it's important. And she said, yes, I absolutely want it. So she was willing to buy a pig and a poke. There was one story. It was the Ringling collection. I don't know if either of you are familiar with that. That's down in Florida.
There's an art school, right?
Yes, I believe there's an art school connected to it. There's also the Ringling Museum of Circus Equipment. It was the Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey people.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Ringling decided, well, I'm rich. Now I have a huge palatial house, so I better start stuffing it full of artwork. So he had people go out and buy artwork for him, and he stuffed the house full of art. So he was showing off to some, you know, New York snob, you know, his collection of old masters. And the guest said, you know, I hate to tell you this, but not a single one of these paintings is by the people you are telling me. This is clearly not a Rembrandt. This is clearly not a Titian. This is clearly not by Michelangelo. You have been taken for a fool. So what he did was he fired his art advisors. He built a bonfire of those paintings in the mansion's courtyard. And then he went out and stocked up on the real thing with a more, you know, respectable art advisor. But as someone pointed out, he said, you know, just because that painting wasn't by Rembrandt doesn't mean it wasn't by somebody. It was a real painting. It just wasn't attributed correctly.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like they were fake. They were real. They just weren't what he thought they were. So you have this kind of like, you're never going to defeat Philistinism. I guess that's the answer.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's true. It's just, and I think the art world relies on a lot of people with deep pockets and shallow views, right?
Yes.
Like, I mean, and so we just have to be appreciative of those people that they are injecting money into the art world in any form. Because, you know, going back to like the art reach thing, there are tons of low income people who would love to see art, but can they afford to buy it? No. You know, like, does that mean they shouldn't have access to it? Obviously not. You know, they should have access to it, right? So we need to appreciate the people with, you know, who
right.
buy based on facsimiles or whatever, even if we couldn't imagine, you know.
Well, I mean, the three collectors I mentioned who all bought remotely, quote unquote, meaning that they weren't seeing the works when they bought them.
Yeah.
You had at the one end, you know, Mrs. Gardner, who I think was very passionate about art, had very, very strong aesthetic sensibilities, designed that house herself, you know, with the aid of architects in order to create a type of atmosphere for the work that she liked. You have Mr. Frick, who knew about the artwork's importance, respected it, created a very beautiful museum and collection for it, and probably signed off on it, you know, at that level. And you had someone like Ringling who wanted it because people like Mrs. Gardner and Mr. Frick had it and didn't know what he was buying. And really probably could have cared less at the end of the day, as long as it was on the wall and people weren't making fun of him.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm saying there are plenty of rich people out there who do have taste and do have sensibility, and they're not all idiots, but there are always going to be the people who don't know what they're doing and just want it because, well, somebody else wants it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, I guess
we'll go a little bit further with our discussion about collecting art in our next episode.
Yeah, I think that'll be good. Let's follow this up with just a discussion about collecting art, because I think that's an interesting topic on its own. Like, what do we buy? Why do we buy it?
And I think a lot of people who are new to collecting are intimidated by collecting and going to galleries. So getting some feedback, it might be helpful for those people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this, as far as coronavirus's effect on the art world, well, I guess we'll see. We'll see. Are people going to become more complacent, or are they going to yearn for the actual social aspect of art viewing? Let's find out, I guess.
Right.
All right. Well, this was the fifth episode, David?
Fifth
episode of Brickyard Composition, brought to you by Dave Allen, Richard Gabriel, and our guest, David Griffin, today.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you guys.